Hey everyone, welcome back to the latest edition of the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. This week I'm joined by a trio of FrontStretch.com colleagues, Zach Catanzaretti, Mike Neff, and Tom Bowles, as we're here to break down the highs and lows of the past weekend in NASCAR, which had an action-packed weekend at Watkins Glen International. Now before we get started, I wanted to remind you on how you can sign up for the podcast every week. Subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on iTunes, and you'll get it sent to your smartphone once it's published. And once you do, be sure to stop by iTunes and leave us a rating and review. We're happy to hear from you, and your feedback helps us out tremendously. Now, y'all, I wish we could start this podcast off on a positive this week, because I thought there were many positives. However, when the CEO of the sport gets arrested for DUI in possession of oxycodone, I think that outweighs the positive, so let's make this broad, and I'll start with you, Tom. What's your whole opinion of this?
I have to say, talk about the worst possible timing for something like this to happen. You know, you have the most popular driver, most likely this season, winning a race at the Glen in front of a sold-out crowd, this iconic picture of Jimmy Johnson pushing him into victory lane, and you have a ratings increase for only the third time all season, and then you follow it up by the most public trouble that any commissioner of any major sport has gotten into in U.S. history. Try and think of a better example, because I can't think of anything more serious. I just think it was a huge black eye for the sport of NASCAR, and unfortunately, guys, it's one that's going to sting for a while. People may not be covering NASCAR in terms of the races anymore on your local news, but you better believe in almost every market in the country, you had a mugshot of a zoned-out Brian France on the local news talking about the CEO of the sport getting suspended. It just was a really, really bad day for the sport.
Yeah, and not just countrywide, but nationwide. I know things have popped up in Australia and France and all these other countries, and even on my local station, which, yes, I'm from the Watkins Glen area, so they were covering the event this weekend. But once the event's over, usually they just move on to whatever else in local sports. So, Neff, what's your take on all this? Because it's kind of a mess.
It's a mess, and I'm with Tom. It's a huge black eye on the sport. And the thing that there's two things that really kind of shocked me, don't shock me about this whole thing. The first is that I have yet to find a single person, even a casual fan, that is surprised that this happened. And that really disturbs me. The fact that anybody that's even a casual fan of the sport is like, oh yeah, Brian France was driving intoxicated and in possession of a controlled substance. What a surprise. Most people said, I can't believe it took this long to happen. And when that is the backdrop of the environment that you're operating in, that is a hugely disturbing set of circumstances for your sport. And the other thing that bothers me about it, I mean, and I don't understand how a billionaire has not got a driver. I mean, that's it throws me back to the 80s and 90s of the NFL, when a lot of players were getting popped for cocaine. And so many of them were minority players. And there were, for lack of a better term, offensive linemen in other predominantly white positions. And they interviewed some of those guys, and they were like, how come you guys aren't getting popped? And they're like, because we're smart enough to party at home. We don't go out to the clubs to do illegal drugs. It wasn't that they weren't doing them. It was just that they were smart enough to do it in an intelligent fashion. And the fact that he didn't have a driver is really just speaks more volumes about whether it's a lack of awareness, whether it's just arrogance or whatever it might be. But the whole thing just speaks volumes to the true lack of leadership or vision that was at the top of this sport. And the problem I have now that we're sitting here 5 days removed from this thing almost is that there's really been no serious communication from the glass tower in Daytona about where we're going and the vision that we have. We understand that Jim France is now in charge of the sport, but that's all we know. We haven't had any idea about what motions going forward there are going to be that might change things, because we've heard from multiple people that now's the time for change. So for now, I sit back and keep my fingers crossed that this is going to be a good thing for the sport, but the way it's gone in the first few days, I don't feel like that's the case.
Yeah, and Zach, maybe...
Can I quickly interject?
Go ahead, Tom.
I just wanted to quickly interject and say that change and stability are two separate things, right? And I think that's going to be one of the keys here. I think everybody got a little bit of a black eye on this, and I know we'll get a little bit deeper into it, but Jim France brings stability. He doesn't bring change. And what happens to all these people that have been waiting in angry at Brian in their own ways for him to be removed from his position? Now you have a guy coming in that people think might do a lot of different things, but really is just there to keep the lights on until we come up with a longer term plan. And when some of these people itching for change figure that out, I think that's going to be a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, and Zach, I'm curious because we've seen Brian have problems like this similarly in the past when he had, I think it was in 2006, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 04, but when he had a mistake in Daytona or an incident in Daytona where he was kind of reckless driving. So Zach, how can we take a negative into a positive, if at all?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good thing that got caught. I mean, we know how far drug addictions and driving, you know, DUIs and how far situations like that can get. I definitely agree with what Tom is saying. It's an unbelievably unfortunate situation, not only for the France family, but for the sport as a whole. It comes at a very, very bad time. That was pretty much the first thing I thought of, was just how much we've been building momentum these last few weeks. I spoke with Mike Neff a few weeks ago. I mean, it seemed like right when NBC took over, the racing action on track has been improving, and it's just been it's been a lot more exciting, you know, for me personally as a watcher. And it definitely a very difficult time. And I mean, we're still, you know, looking up when it comes to the on track product, but when it comes to looking bad as a sport, I mean, this is worse than Kyle Busch speeding or a driver doing something like this. I mean, this is literally the face of the sport. And I mean, I hope in the best when it comes to the recovery. I'm fascinated to see how the sport kind of evolves pretty much the rest of this year. And then when it comes to Monster Energy, you know, they're kind of on their way out as well. So it's a very interesting time in the sport right now. It's, as I said, very unfortunate that this is the way that something like this happens. But sometimes, I mean, just life kind of gets at you and takes someone out of that position.
Yeah, and Neff, we've seen this recently, right, with Spencer Gallagher, too. He got suspended for not following the substance abuse policy or whatever you want to call it. So Brian, I mean, he had to go, right, at least for now?
Oh, absolutely. If you've got somebody that has obviously violated the policy that is in place for every other person that competes in your sport. I know early on when it was reported that there was mention that he would go through Road to Recovery, but as I mentioned a minute ago, there's been no statement since then to say, yes, he's going to go through the Road to Recovery just like everybody else in a sport has to. And I feel like that is an important step in this, that not only does he have to get help, which, and let's throw that out there above all of this, whether we like Brian France or hate Brian France, he's still a human being and he's got a problem. And let's hope and pray that he gets help in some way. But I truly hope that they will put him in the same program, because a program that is good enough for a tire carrier should be good enough for the CEO and vice versa. So if they do not put him in that position, in that program, I think that will be a serious statement about the lack of genuineness of the recovery program in the sport. And I feel like it's a good program, so I'm hoping they will put him in there. And I did want to touch on one thing that Zach brought up that I hadn't even thought of. With Monster Energy getting ready to leave, which we all know they are, if they don't come out with a clear path of the future of this thing, how much harder is that going to make trying to get a new title sponsor after next year?
Tom, your thoughts?
Well, Mike, I don't think they really need to even worry about a title sponsor. I think it's much bigger than that. I think we're talking about how this affects the potential sale of the sport. I think that when you sit back and you look at where they were in terms of going back and forth and debating whether or not to actually sell a stake, now you have the CEO of this family come out and give the sport a black eye. And why I keep saying everybody gets a little bit of a black eye, and one of the unanswered questions every source I've talked to this week, from Cup car owners all the way down, have told me the exact same running theme. I'm not surprised, or I had a strong suspicion this was the case. And if that's true, then did anybody even go and approach Brian and say, hey, you have a problem? And what was his reaction? Were they rebuffed? Did Brian just ignore them? Or did everybody just be indifferent or too afraid to stand up to Brian? Because now what we have is a situation where all these companies are looking and going, wait a minute, we're giving money to a sport where the CEO wasn't in charge of day-to-day operations, and where everybody was trying to, in private, go, yeah, try and look away from that, because he's not really running things, somebody else is. And people are sitting there and going, what are we putting our millions in? What is the future direction of the sport? Who is actually going to run the sport? And I think that it really is going to affect NASCAR financially much more than anything else. Day-to-day, at the racetrack, over the weekends, the race weekends may not change, but I think NASCAR's got its back against the wall right now in terms of future sponsorships and trying to placate all these corporations that are worried about the money that they're giving to NASCAR.
Yeah, I think that all kind of goes hand in hand, right? And Tom, you brought up a good point about the sale and then also who runs NASCAR. So since this happened in honestly probably the worst time it could have possibly ever happened, Tom, do you think this we could have seen the last of Brian France running the sport?
So I'm torn on whether Brian France is going to be back, guys. There are two distinct camps that have formed in the few days after his arrest. The car owners seem to be leaving the door open for Brian France's return. You look at what Joe Gibbs has said. You look at what some of the other car owners out there, Felix Sabatis, has said since France's arrest, and everybody's talking about supporting him, praying for him, and Sabatis came so far as to say, look, it's not Brian's fault that NASCAR is failing like it is. We all share a part of the blame. So there has been no piling on, and I've heard from several people that there is no revolt among the ownership to try and get him permanently removed. Now, the drivers appear to be a little bit of a different story. Kyle Larson and Kevin Harvick both liked posts from Xfinity and Truck Series part-timers that were a little aggressive, that said now is the time for change, enough is enough type of deals. And I do think that the drivers have less of a connection to Brian, guys, because Brian just hasn't been at the racetrack. That's been his biggest weakness. As silly as it sounds, it's like a basic CEO checklist item is attendance. And Brian just didn't seem to do it. So, you know, especially for the younger drivers the last few years, he doesn't have a relationship with them because he really hasn't seen them. So it'll be interesting. I personally don't know if Brian returning is the best option, especially with the black eye this has given the sport and Brian's history of transgressions. This isn't the first time. But I think it's not out of the realm of possibility. And I think, Neffy, it's going to be a bit of a PR decision for them, whether it's right or wrong.
I agree. I think you've got a couple different angles on the PR side of this. Number one, as we were talking earlier, provided Brian goes into the same road to recovery program that NASCAR has in place for everybody else, that they would do that, have him come out the other side of it, recovered, and resume his position, and that would be kind of a flagship moment to say that their recovery program or their rehab program is successful. At the same time, we are talking about the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company. And the fact that he put himself in a situation like that just really raises red flags about his decision-making abilities. And there's going to be a lot of PR that's going to have to go on if they're going to try to make that look like a positive event. But at the same time, as you mentioned, the owners are supporting him. I think we all need to support him. And it very well could be that they feel like they've got a position and may even have a greater position of power if he does come back in, and that they don't know, putting somebody else in, what kind of influence they're going to have. So that may be a reasoning behind their support as well. We're going to have to wait and see. And as I mentioned to begin this thing, right now, we don't know what the plan is. So I guess we're all going to kind of hang back. Hopefully, we'll have some kind of a vision going forward before we get to the awards banquet at the end of the season.
Yeah, and Zach, I thought Tom hit on a crucial point there with Brian's lack of attendance. I know we've covered the past 3 weekends together, and I think he was at Pocono, but had he been at Watkins Glen, this wouldn't have even happened.
Yeah, he was at Pocono. Yeah, I saw him. I actually shot a few photos of him. But yeah, to go off Tom, I expect Brian to be back. I do agree on that. But to me, the big question is how Brian reacts to this, how he talks about his issue afterwards, the road to recovery, the future of the sport, its leadership. I mean, if he just plays it off, throws it under the rug, and almost pretends like it didn't happen, you know, to get himself back into where he was, I mean, I think that would be a huge problem in itself. Definitely going forward, even more than his attendance, would be to not notice that there was an issue and it was solved and it's something that won't happen again and something that he knows was a huge black eye for the sport. I think that would be a massive problem in itself.
Now, Tom, we talked about this off the air, but what do you think Michigan's going to look like this weekend?
Oh, my goodness. Bring your pen and paper if you're a journalist. I'd say I'd bring, like, about 5 notebooks. I think it's going to be crazy. And what I think will be frustrating from the NASCAR side of things is, number one, as of now, and it may change, you don't have a press conference scheduled with Jim France. And if you take that risk from a public relations perspective, then you allow everyone else to write the narrative, because Jim France is not coming out and giving the sport future direction. And I also think that this weekend is going to be interesting, because I think you're going to see atypical media that don't cover the sport every week poking around to find out more information as to how this happened, why this happened, what were the details behind France's addiction. It's going to be a crazy news weekend, and unfortunately overshadow a situation in Chase Elliott where, guys, we're how far into this podcast and we haven't even talked about it? I feel really bad for Chase, because this kid labored for 2.5 years to try and finally get over the hump, has this historic win, his 99th start, all this numerical stuff with Father Bill and how they both got their first win on a road course, and it's all, you know, thrown under the rug. And honestly, he's in a position where he could win 2 in a row this weekend. He could win 2 in a row, and his first 2 wins, people won't care, because they're so focused on another big story. And it just seems to be the history of NASCAR these last few years, that whenever we seem to get a little bit of momentum or a little bit of wind beneath our sails, a big story comes and just knocks the boat over.
Yeah, and that could be a good point to move on to Chase, unless Zach or Nephew have any final thoughts on Brian France.
Yeah, the one thing that I see this weekend, and Tom mentioned that they don't have a press conference scheduled, from my vision of things, I can't believe Jim France wouldn't be there. From the history of things, I don't see how Jim France shows up, because this is not something that he really wants to embrace. From what I understand, it's not something he wants to do going forward. It's just an interim thing. And I feel like in the typical fashion, they're going to just be like, nothing to see here, everyone move along. And I feel like that's the wrong way to handle it. But at the same time, I feel like there's a historical precedent that's been set with the sport quite a bit over the last 15 years.
All right, guys, I think this is a good turning point. But Jim France, to my knowledge, and from what Tom hears, is expected to be at the track this weekend. But Zach, Chase Elliott finally gets back to victory, or finally gets the victory, I should say, in the Cup Series. I was very impressed by his. He led 53 laps, I think, and he held off Truex to the bitter end as he hunted him down, kind of.
Yeah, the start of the race was pretty interesting. We saw a lot of guys. I mean, we saw Joey Logano drop out from his damage. A.J. Allmendinger, David Ragan, Casey Kane all got some significant or smaller nose damage, and Kyle Busch and Hamlin were going at it for the lead up front, and I'm like, guys, calm down. We have to get this race going. And then Chase ends up eventually catching the 18 and eventually getting the lead. And, I mean, once they got in formation, I mean, to me, Chase had, you know, possibly the best car. I mean, him and the 18 kind of went back and forth a few times, but I really felt like Elliott had the advantage. And that's what Kyle Busch said after the race, that he was surprised that Chase not only passed them, but actually drove away. So, to talk to the girl at the track on Sunday, It was really the speed and the consistency of the 18. And just, as I said, it was very surprising to see Elliott, that he actually had some for him. And just these last few weeks, I feel like Elliott's really been getting into a rhythm. I mean, stage wins are becoming more normal this past month or so, these last three races. And he's had a number of strong finishes. Those early penalties, those early point penalties hurt him a little bit. But, I mean, at this point, I mean, it's not really about points. It's about, you know, winning races. And he got that win and held off Truex at the end. I always love those straight-up races for the lead where there's no caution, no outside factors. Truex ran out of fuel with two corners remaining, but I felt like Elliott had it at that point. So it's definitely a great moment for Hendrick. He talked about how much they've been struggling this year, and to see some legitimate proof that they are definitely on the way up was definitely huge for them. And being in victory lane, one more thing, that was a very supportive victory lane. I have to say that. AJ Allmendinger back in 2014, I covered that one, and Roger Penske and Richard Childress came out to congratulate him. Brad Doherty was jumping up and down like crazy. It was the team's first win. This one was pretty similar to that, with Kyle Busch coming out and Bubba and William Byron. It was a really special moment, and it's cool to see when someone gets their first win, all the support that comes their way.
And Neff, we've been kind of harping on the Chevys all year because they haven't performed. I mean, this was their first win since the Daytona 500. But now Chase Elliott, like Zach said, he has three straight races with stage wins and then getting an additional 5 points for the win this weekend. Is he the real deal?
I think he's the real deal. I mean, if you look at 2017, Hendrick was not that strong. And for at least the last two-thirds of 2017, Elliott was far and away the best performing car at Hendrick. I mean, he was the flagship. And that's pretty bold to say when you have a seven-time champion over there. But the 48 is still struggling to get back on track. And I feel like Elliott has been consistent, and he's been getting better. You know, it's one of those deals where going back to these tracks multiple times and working with the same team, eventually you start to feel more of what you want in the car, and they're able to give it to you, and you're able to verbalize what changes you need to get to that feel. And I feel like that's part of where they're at, is that Elliott's really now understanding what his car needs to feel like at these different tracks and able to work with Gustafson in order to get the settings that they need. And the thing that I really thought was telling, and I thought was very cool, and Chase even mentioned it after the race, the fact that at Dover last year was a turning point for him, because he felt like he didn't get the job done there. That some of the other ones, there were things that conspired against him or whatever it may have been, but he felt like at Dover he really didn't get the job done. And then going down into turn one on that last lap, and you've got wheel hop going on, and he had the presence of mind to knock the car out of gear so that he didn't spin out, got it back into gear and recovered quickly enough to hang on to the lead, thanks to Truex, unfortunately, stepping on himself, going through the bus stop the lap before, that gave him that 6 or 7 car length lead at the end of the front straight. But I felt like that was kind of a coming of age moment right there, that he really could have panicked or he really could have screwed up and spun out. But he maintained a level head, threw it out of gear, got the wheel hop to stop, got it back in gear, and got rolling before Truex got to him. I think that was a telling moment for him. But, and as we mentioned earlier, Larson's been the Chevy flag bearer for a while. And if anything, it seems like Larson might be stumbling a little bit here to see that it may be that changing of the guard time where Hendrick's going to ramp it up. And we talked about this early on podcasts, that it wouldn't surprise us at all to see Hendrick kind of get a feel for it, have Jimmy Johnson turn around and like win Indy that vaults him into the playoffs, and then win one race in every round and win championship number 8 at the end of the season.
And Tom, Neff kind of hit on a lot there, but I want to hit specifically on that final lap going into turn one where he wheel hopped. It's so easy at Watkins Glen. We've seen it by past champions, former winners at the track, Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, sometimes in the same race, spin out in turn one. Could y'all have imagined if he had let that one slip away?
Oh, my goodness. So close was this line between such a major day for NASCAR and such a big letdown. Could you imagine if Truex was able to get by, or even more so because Truex still ran out of fuel in the last lap. Chase Elliott spins out, Truex runs out of gas, and then somehow Kyle Busch comes all the way back from third place to win the race. It would have been so deflating to have another win by the big three, which have just clenched their fist around NASCAR this season, dominating race after race after race. So I think it was definitely a fine line for Elliott's psyche. I feel like that would have been a devastating loss that would have been very, very difficult to recover from. But look, you look at the body of work that Chase has given us so far. And while he hadn't won a race to this point, he was arguably the second best Chevy all season behind Kyle Larson. And now I agree with Neff. I think he's passed Larson. He's won, what, the last three of the last six stages, I believe. Kyle Larson doesn't have a single playoff point. And he's with a team in Hendrick Motorsports that we all knew that once they figured out the Chevy Camaro chassis, I'm talking about the entire manufacturer, the fruits of their labor were going to show up first with their team that's the equivalent of the New York Yankees. You knew that Hendrick was going to take that knowledge and be able to apply it quicker than anyone else. So I think when we look at Homestead Miami, guys, you've got the big three pretty much. It's going to take a disaster in the round of eight to keep them from getting those three spots. But that fourth spot is still very up for grabs. And I thought for a while Clint Bowyer had a beat on it. Now I'm starting to go, well, I wonder if Hendrick's going to sneak in and Chase Elliott's going to grab it. Or even crazier, could you imagine if both Chase Elliott and Jimmy Johnson won in the round of eight? That would mean that two of the big three would make it, and one of them would have a wonderful season that would have won the championship in most years, completely knocked out.
Yeah. I guess we'll have to wait and see on that.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But Neff, Tom kind of hit on this. How far do you think this number 9 team can go?
I'm not going to crown them a championship contender, but I feel like we've seen the first of many wins, whether it's this year, whether it's years to come. The simple fact is Chase has won in everything he's ever raced, pretty much. You could argue that he's been in better equipment than a lot of his competitors in many of those series. But my argument to that whole point is when he got to Xfinity and there were people in equal or better equipment, he still ran with them and still won races that beat out those other teams. I feel like from a talent standpoint, he's got the talent to ultimately be a champion. It's going to take them a little while, but I would not be surprised to see them win more than one race this season, and ultimately, at some point in our life, probably see the 9 get into the championship contention and get a championship win before he retired.
And Zach, we were both there, and there were so many ironic steps between himself, his father. They both had 8 second place finishes before winning. It was the first time the 9 car has been back to victory lane in the Cup Series since, I think, 2012 at Watkins Glen. Just so many parallels, and I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, it just seemed right, didn't it? I mean, it really did. And as we were talking about that last lap battle, I mean, I was in victory lane. I was just leaving to get to pit road, and I think it was Dave Moody who got on the mic, and he said, "Chase Elliott goes wide." And I'm like, oh, man, this is Martinsville, Dover, Daytona. I mean, this is everything happening all over again. And thankfully, as Neff said, Truex made that mistake the lap prior, and it gave him just enough room where he was able to stay ahead and keep the win. And it was super special to see Bill Elliott there. We know that he's going to be racing against you in a few weeks. Talk about a special week for the family. But to have him spotting over there in the bus stop and to come over and be in victory lane, I shot a terrific shot of them hugging each other. And just as a photographer and a reporter, I mean, those are the moments you really strive to see every week. And they don't happen every week. I mean, a lot, as we said, you know, it's cool seeing Truex win and Harvick and Kyle, but I mean, they've done it. They've done it here and then. But to see a first-time winner and to have his dad there and to see the emotion, I mean, you just cannot put a price on that. And as we said, who knows how far Elliott can go. He has a lot of great tracks coming up. We talked about Michigan, Bristol. He finished second at Richmond. Talladega is a heck of a plate racer. We know how close he was at Martinsville last year. I mean, to me, there's no cap on how far he can go this year.
And how about the fact that I didn't realize this until I was reading up on stats late Sunday night, he had like 26 or 27 top five finishes before. That was the most of anybody in the series without a win, which I didn't realize. I knew he'd had some good runs, but I didn't realize he'd had that many good runs.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think I don't have a really good transition. However, I do want to talk a little bit about Kyle Busch, because I thought personally he had the best car, even though Chase passed him early on. Kyle did pass him later back. However, Zach, a little mishap with the fuel and the gauge and how it got connected into the fuel cell kind of derailed his race. However, he put on a clinic coming back to the show. He told us after the race he drove his ass off to get back to third, gaining 28 spots over the final 30 laps with no cautions. It was crazy.
If only a caution, right?
Yeah, I was kind of hoping for one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, as I said earlier, I think him and Elliott were pretty close when it came to speed. Like, they were going back and forth a few times. But I think once you get Kyle into that mindset where he's coming from the back and he's got that tongue hanging out and he's, I mean, he's probably closer than how Newman is when he's, you know, hugging that steering wheel. I mean, he definitely had that that forward drive. And I think if he got that caution with fresh tires or not, I mean, I really think he would have had something for him. But those little mistakes, we don't see them too often. We call them the big three for a reason. They dominate a lot of races and they win a lot. And a lot of that is because of execution. And this ATN has been showing that they're able to execute more times than ever before, really. I mean, it's incredible how often he's been winning this year. And I mean, that's what cost him. I mean, he just wasn't there at the end. Once you lose that track position with no yellows on a track like Watkins Glen, that it takes so long to make passes and they kind of get a little spread out up front, those top two, I mean, they were gone.
Yeah.
He really didn't have
20 seconds
at the end. Yeah. I mean, it just wasn't really meant to be. And in a race like that where it was fairly clean, those yellows just weren't coming, you just couldn't make a mistake like that, like the one that he made.
And it was a bummer that it was a mechanical thing. I mean, it's one thing to deal with when it's human error, and that's part of the whole fabric of the deal. But when it's something that malfunctions on the fueling rig, which in hindsight, I mean, you can always Monday morning quarterback it, but and it may have paid out better for him because he came in two laps later. But I didn't understand why the fuel man wasn't waving and telling him to hold up that he didn't get all the fuel in it. But it was what it was, and I'm with you. I thought when the 15 went around and had their issue, I thought that was going to be the caution that was going to get it bunched back up. And if it had, it would have been a show. I don't know if it had got past Elliott or not, but it would have been a show for sure because Truex just didn't have it. I mean, we saw that over the last 30-something laps of that race, and Truex was just kind of 3 to 6 car lengths back, and any time he started getting any closer to that, he got too loose. It was a show. I wish they'd have shown more of it on TV myself. And we only saw like 3 glimpses of Kyle passing all those cars. And I bet it was something to see if you were there in person.
Yeah, so let me butt in here because off air, Neff told us that he doesn't think that Watkins Glen was a good race. And
that was awful.
I want him to expand to our listeners why that wasn't a good race, because I think Tom, myself, and Zach think it was one of the best races of the year.
Right. The way that I lay out a good race is if there is varying pit strategies so that you have people that are doing some different things.
There was.
And you don't really know what's going to all come together. We saw some guys pit at the end of stage one and some guys didn't. That was pretty much the only pit strategy we really had going. And then you get on-track passes for the lead, guys mixing it up at the front of the pack. We had 2 of those. Kyle Busch passed Denny Hamlin on lap 2, and then Chase Elliott passed Kyle Busch somewhere mid-late first stage. And that was it. Or second stage, excuse me. And so anything else was a parade. When you got to the caution in the final stage and Chase Elliott's in the front and Kyle Busch goes all the way to the back, they drop the green flag, Chase Elliott jumps out in front of Truex and gets about 3 or 4 car lengths ahead of him. And for 35 laps, that was the gap. And the two of them yarded the rest of the field, and all they showed us was those two cars for the vast majority of that last segment. So we saw 2 cars, 5 car lengths apart, for 35 laps with no swapping of position, nobody contesting anybody. until the very last lap when Chase Elliott goes off the end of turn one and Truex kind of slides the tires and gets to his back bumper. But by the time they get to the middle of the S's, it's three car lengths again. There was no edge of your seat excitement. And I don't understand how many people are talking about what a battle it was coming down to the finish with Truex and Elliott, because you could have put two cars between them almost the whole time. If you want an exciting race, in my book, these guys have to be trading paint. If you had had Kyle Busch and Keselowski rubbing on each other, or Ambrose and Allmendinger swapping the lead back multiple times and smoke flying and paint flying, that's exciting. If it had been Kyle Busch instead of Chase Elliott in that car, would you have said that that was an exciting finish to that race?
Tom, I'm interested to get your take.
I don't know how you couldn't have been on pins and needles over the final 10 laps of that race. And I know that Truex was never able to get by him, but he won the last two road course. He's won the last two road course races. He has the cachet, especially with the year that he's had, to make everyone believe that he could potentially get by. And it's all about somebody actually getting out in front that was not the big three, somebody that hadn't won a race, by the way, and is the most popular driver in the series this year, most likely, doing it in front of a sold-out crowd, and then having to fight off the 78, who, yeah, he may not have gotten alongside of, but he was pressuring him to the point where the 9 nearly took itself out in the final lap. And besides that, you had a guy in Kyle Busch charged through the field, went all the way from the rear of the field up to third, and yes, I know he wasn't shown on TV as much as he should have been shown, but there was also action in terms of cars spinning out, but not an overwhelming amount of wrecks. There were mechanical failures. Joey Logano had a bad pit call. There were some pit penalty issues. There always seemed to be something going on. I just don't know why you would think it's a bad race now. Apparently, you don't like turning right, because that was one of the best road course races we've seen in a while.
I did not see anything going on, and I guess that's where I'm coming up different from you guys, because... And you talk about pressuring Elliott into a mistake. Truex was 7 car lengths behind him when he went off on turn one. The pressure was gone because Truex had screwed up going through the bus stop, coming around to take the white flag. There was just no competition to it. And if you had had that gap on an intermediate track, y'all would have been screaming about how boring it was, because once they get to 3 car lengths apart, they can't close it up. And it just, there was... I just didn't see anything at all outside of the excitement of a first-time winner. And I thought it was awesome that Chase Elliott got that first win, finally, you know, broke the maiden voyage and got into the victory lane. And it was awesome that Bill was there calling it. But from a pure competition entertainment standpoint, outside of the storyline, the competition on a track was an absolute parade, except for Kyle Busch coming through the field. And as I said before, they showed us that like 3 times during the whole broadcast when he was coming back up.
Yeah, I guess I wish they would have showed you guys more, because I thought there was a lot of racing, maybe not for the lead specifically, but like Kurt Busch, he started last. Him and Paul Menard had to go to the back because they failed tech inspection Sunday morning after qualifying. And Kurt Busch surged through that field right away, as did Kyle later on in the race, like we mentioned. But I thought there was a lot of passing, maybe not just for the lead, and there was a lot of action, Zach.
Yeah, for me, circumstance made this one special. You're right, it would not have been as exciting if Kyle Busch was leading and Truex was second. But guess what? It was Chase. And that's why it was exciting, that's why it was memorable. And to me, it doesn't always have to be so visually pounding where everyone is beating the crap out of each other up front. It can still be a battle. I mean, you don't think they were pushing hard against each other? I mean, it reminded me of how Truex and Kyle Busch raced at Homestead last year. To me, that was incredible. They didn't touch each other. They were barely even close. But it really came down to what they were racing for. And, I mean, maybe you had to be there in person and feel it and know that this kid was going for his first win. But, I mean, to me, just waiting for a mistake, waiting for some guy's tank to run dry, waiting for a caution, waiting for a mistake from the 9 car, which did come. It came from both guys. I mean, to me, it was just all about circumstance, and it stood out because of that.
Can I say one more thing here, too? I've never been there, so I'm not going to diss that. I love the atmosphere of Watkins Glen. It reminds me so much of Road America that it's just, it's almost like a fair. I mean, there's so much stuff going on everywhere, and there's so many people camping and partying, and the whole experience is amazing. But can we kind of back off on the trumpeting of the sellout a little bit for two reasons? Number one, they have 38,900 seats, okay? That's not a real big grandstand to be selling out. So let's tone that down a little bit. But secondly, and I watched it the whole race, and I was trying to figure out, you know, maybe it was going to fill up later or whatever, but that great big grandstand that you see on TV when they come out of six and go into seven, it was half empty for the entire race. I mean, it was never close to being filled up. And I'm like, we're trumpeting that they've sold out the 38,900 seats. And again, I know the infield is packed with campers and there's way more people there than that. But bottom line, 38,900 is a sellout. And they get all excited about that, and they announced it on Saturday. So if you go to, I mean, Martinsville's got 65,000 seats, and it's a half a mile. This place is 2.5 miles, and it's got half the seats.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little biased because I'm from the area, and I went to Watkins Glen in diapers, essentially, in 3 or 4 years old or whatever when my first race was there. But yeah, like you said, Neff, maybe you haven't been there before, but that infield, and Zach can speak to this. Zach toured the infield this week and got a bunch of great pictures for Front Stretch. It's insane. Zach's been to Talladega, and Neff, you have too, and Zach thinks it's better than Talladega.
I do. There's something about it. I walked through the campgrounds there. As you said, I spent way more time in the campgrounds than the media center. And I do that. This is my fifth year covering there, and I do that almost every year. You walk through it, and you forget that you're inside a racetrack. You're walking through a campground. You see all these trees and all these camp. It's huge. And then you keep walking, and you see a fence. And you're like, oh, is a racetrack here too? Man, I mean, yeah, to me, it really stands out that way. I mean, Talladega is absolutely tremendous. I mean, once you go down to how crazy it gets and how many people are there and how late they stay up and how nice everybody is. I mean, I think just Watkins Glen is always the best. They're always a lot of nice people, the bus stop area, they kind of market that as like the party place in the track. I mean, that's where all the loud music is. That's where the college kids go. I mean, it's just, that's where most of the partying is. So I always enjoy it so much there.
Yeah. And like I said, it reminds me so much of Road America, which is the same thing. I mean, Road America is a little bigger track, but it's the same deal. Everybody's camping everywhere. There's food vendors all over the place. And there's people that is, I mean, you're walking by people you've never met in your life. You have no idea who they are, who they've seen. And they offer for you to come over and eat with them. You know, hey, here, have a brat, have some cheese curds. And it's like, it's so cool going through that. And that's what I love about, one of the things I love about road course racing is that it's always got that vibe to it. I mean, camping at NASCAR races is a big thing anyway, but when it's at road courses, it just seems to be ramped up that much more because of the fact that it's usually a more sprawling circuit and people are just kind of there for a whole event weekend. And like this one, you usually have 4 or 5 different races that go on over the weekend, and it's an event. It's a happening. It's more than just a race.
And I think this road course theme could lead us into predictions, because obviously Xfinity Series goes to Mid-Ohio this week for the second consecutive road course race. And then we have got a doubleheader, well, two race weekend in Michigan with the Cup Series and Truck Series. So, Zach, since the Xfinity Series is away from Michigan, we'll go with them first since it's a standalone race. Who do you got winning?
Yeah, for sure. Mid-Ohio seems like a really fun track. I got to go with Justin Marks. I mean, there's weather in the forecast. I mean, you got to pick him. He won that race in the rain 2 years ago. This is his first start this year in that 42. He got a double top 10 last year at Road America in Mid-Ohio. So, I mean, I got to go with Mr. Marks.
Neff, sounds like you stole your pick.
That is exactly who I was going on. Let's give it to Allgaier then. Allgaier was looking really good this weekend at Watkins Glen, and I feel like he's a Midwest boy. Let's give him a shout.
Tom, who you got?
I think I'm going to go outside the box and pick somebody that's been embattled recently. I think I'm going to go with Elliott Sadler. Not a guy that you would think on a road course, right? But Elliott has been overshadowed much of the year with some of these other guys, including Christopher Bell and Allgaier, really coming up, winning races. And I know that sounds crazy, but we don't see Xfinity people winning Xfinity races all that often. And it's kind of stolen their thunder. So I think that it's an opportunity. I think it's going to be one of those weird races where Elliott Sadler has a chance to get a win.
And I'll go with another Xfinity regular. I'll go with Daniel Hemric. I think he got a second place finish, second or third last year. I don't have the stats in front of me, but his best result on a road course, and looked like he belonged on a road course. And he doesn't particularly like road course racing. So, I'll go Hemric. And then, Zach, I'll throw it back to you with predictions for Michigan with the Truck Series and then Cup Series.
Yeah, for the Trucks, I'm starting with Brett Moffitt. He won here a couple years ago. We know how strong his speed has been all year, so I definitely expect him to go for win number four this year. And then for Cup, we talked about him earlier, but I definitely have to jump on the bandwagon with Chase Elliott. Normally I wouldn't, but Michigan is a really great track for him. He's got a number of second-place runs there. He's been on an absolute roll these last few years, and I think he's going to get his first two wins back-to-back, just like he did in Xfinity back in 2014.
Neff, who you got?
Nice call there. Looking at the Trucks is just, it's so up in the air. I'm going to go out on a crazy limb and say Justin Haley is going to get it done in the 24 again this weekend. I feel like after getting jobbed at Daytona, he's going to turn around and get past. Let's do a GMS 1-2 with Justin Haley and Johnny Sauter. And then on the Cup side of things, I mean, how do we go against the guys that are the strongest all season? But let's do Mr. 2 Mile, Kyle Larson. We'll say Larson shakes off his doldrums over the last couple races and beats Chase Elliott on a late race restart again to grab his first win of the season.
Tom, who you got?
Go Trucks first, and I'll say you can never really go wrong with Johnny Sauter. So I think I'm going to go for him. I think he's due to jump back up to the front again. I know he really didn't have the best outdoor, but I think we're missing the boat with Michigan. The Mustang is going to be revealed the day this podcast comes out up in Michigan, the 2019 race car for Ford. And it's been a really weird stretch for them. Yeah, you still have Kevin Harvick up there, but Ford didn't have a single car inside the top five at Watkins Glen. That's only happened twice this season, and both times have been in the last five races. So I think we're going to go back to what we saw in June, a little bit of Stewart Haas domination, Ford flexing their muscle. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to see Kevin Harvick in victory lane at Michigan, a win that he should have had in June, if not for a weird series of circumstances that put Boyer in control.
That's a nice pick, because I also think the Fords are going to be really, really fast this weekend. I think they had 7 of the top 10 in the June race with all three, with three Stewart Haas cars and then all 4 Penske cars, including Paul Menard. For Chucks, I'm going to go kind of really far out on a limb, and I'm going to go Dalton Sargeant. He finished 3rd at Pocono. It was the first ever top 5, best career finish, obviously. So I'll go Dalton Sargeant to keep that momentum rolling into Michigan. And then for Cup, I was going to pick Harvick, but I'll go Kurt Busch. Kurt Busch won the pole here in June. He went 218 miles per hour. Guys, that's insane in a 3,400-pound stock car going into turn one. I'll say Kurt Busch ends the day in victory lane on Sunday. Guys, good episode today. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Thomas?
I'm good. Just make sure you check out, Did You Notice, every Wednesday. I have a great piece about where Brian France stands. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at NASCAR Bowls. And be sure to follow Front Stretch on Twitter and on Instagram. And most importantly, give us a review. We need to know that you're listening, and we need to know that you like the podcast. We've had some great guests on this year. You guys have been doing a fantastic job. And I was happy to come in and pinch hit this week.
Awesome. I think that was a good week for you to pitch it, because we did see your Did You Notice on Wednesday. So, Neff, Zach, any final thoughts?
Going to be another big one. Actually, 40 cars racing in the Cup Series this weekend. Always a good show when we go up to the backyard of the manufacturers. I think that hopefully fingers crossed, we can let racing get back to what we're talking about with this weekend, and we can forget about behind the scenes drama that has to do with who's running the sport and decisions that are being made there. So let's hope that we get a great race. Keep our fingers crossed that weather stays out of the picture for all of our races this weekend, and we'll see who it is that that writes the new narrative for this next podcast.
Yeah, definitely going to be an exciting weekend. I look forward to watching racing again. I mean, that's always best when that's what we're talking about. But with everyone listening, I guess this comes out Thursday, tomorrow. That's good because now the playoffs are 1 month away. They start on September 9th when we end off the regular season. So it's crazy how quick this season has gone, and that we're already talking about the championship and who's going to make it and who's not. And obviously it continues this weekend from Michigan.
Yeah, and Zach, you and I made our first trip out to Michigan in June, so I'm just hoping for clear skies this weekend because the June race was not that fun the whole weekend because there was so much rain. The Xfinity race got cut short. The Cup race got cut short. The ARCA race was almost longer than the Xfinity race. So, yeah, I'm hoping just for clear skies this weekend. But on that note...
From Watkins Glen and Bristol and snow at Martinsville, I have seen it all. I kind of want that to end.
Yeah. So on that note, that wraps up another edition of the French Edge podcast. Thanks as always for tuning in. And until next week's show where we review Michigan, we're out.
Peace out.